This is Anne DeVore, The Secret Rose, William Yeats, June 19th, 1992.
This is working? All right. As long as I've been told that I'm not supposed to step on this, but I've also informed him I was a Sag, and you never knew when I was going to either stumble, fall, or get my ankle wrapped in it, so... This is a lecture about Yeats's developmental model of the soul, if you will. It's quite distinguished from a psychology. It really starts out with the premise that all souls have a vehicle or a body. The physical plane that we inhabit is really a plane where the soul comes to learn the steps, the lessons, the next kind of tests that are needed for its development. He never really uses the word self, and he never really wastes time with a psychology. He's only interested in third-dimensional life as a mirror of what is happening in the soul as a greater entity. People always ask me questions about Jung and Yeats, so I thought I would get those out of the way first. Yeats was born in 1836, so you're going to hear ideas tonight that predate Jung by 20 years in terms of actual writing. The Psychology of Alchemy was written in 1936 to 1944, Alchemical Studies was written in 1938 to 54, and Mysterium Conjunctionis was in 1955-56. You will hear a lot of Yeats's ideas, of course, much more written in what we'd call a didactic manner by Jung 20, 30 years later. In type, the two men are opposites. Yeats is an INFP, and he wrote very short kinds of essays, plays, and poetry. Jung, of course, is on the other side, with the major function being intuitive and thinking. So it's very different writing. You'll hear, though, that these two would probably have enjoyed a conversation. Jung's major point when he was proving the concept of the collective unconscious is that there were these ideas that were accessible to us and often seemed to come to several people all at once. And so you found a cluster of writing about a certain topic. And so in a way you could say what Yeats began as early as 1893 was continued as a lineage up through the death of Jung and into modern time. Understanding from the beginning that to Yeats, we are a soul inhabiting a vehicle, and understanding that we are operating in the context of a system of reincarnation, I'll begin by saying that we'll open with a dream as a vision that Yeats had. And he said, "One night I heard a voice that said, 'God's love for every human soul is infinite, for every human soul is unique. No other can satisfy the same need in God.' And he awoke to find a great angel sitting by his bed, and he was terrified. And in the dream within a dream, he asked what the angel was doing there. And the angel said, 'Well, William Butler Yeats, I'm here to tell you that you're not doing your work. You came here to be a poet, and you just really haven't done it. And it's time that you do this, because if you don't do it, God will be deprived of the essence of William Butler Yeats.' And so at that point, which was close to the age of 40, we realized he'd already been writing for some time, but there was a work that was ahead of him that was going to be his special work, and he knew that he had 14 or 15 years to prepare. And it was at that time that he turned to serious study of Renaissance and esoteric philosophy as preparation for his great work, which we come to know as A Vision. At the age of 28, with the publication of The Rose in 1893, the Irish poet W.B. Yeats began to elucidate a spiritual path which would remain his focus for the entirety of his life. The symbol he followed was the rose, and while it is true that he portrayed a real woman, Maud Gonne, as the rose, if one believes that Yeats's rose poems are simply love poems, one completely misses the larger meaning of the rose as a symbol of the eternal feminine, as a symbol of the soul, and much more. This evening we will examine the various uses of the symbolic rose and define the path of spiritual evolution one embraces as a devotee of the rose. It is not possible to separate spiritual work and poetic art in an esoteric poet's life. Those of you who know the work of Kathleen Rainey might be interested in reading her book, Defending Ancient Springs, because she talks about this genre of poetry where the spiritual work is placed right into the poetry. Poetry to Yeats is the work of spiritual man, and it is so in many of the mystical traditions, such as in the Sufi tradition. In several publications between the years 1893 to 1917, Yeats explores the symbol of the rose, and one can glimpse his path and the meaning of his purposive, intentional way of life. The specific readings that we'll work with tonight come from The Rose, The Wind Among the Reeds, The Secret Rose, Rosa Alchemica, and Animus Hominis and Anima Mundi. The path Yeats elucidates, which he calls spiritual alchemy, is best described as a form of Western yoga. Yoga simply being a linking of the incarnate man to the spiritual realm. Yeats believed in a path of reincarnation and that the many lives we live are required for our awakening to the existence of the soul and then to the distillation of the contents of the soul until we are ready to exchange mere mortal life for true immortality. In other alchemical systems, the product was a small stone of philosopher's gold. In Yeats's system, it is a golden rose. And this is because he is Celtic and a more passionate man, and he wanted the rose to be his philosopher's stone because, after all, what he was seeking was the anima mundi itself, the eternal feminine. And I will put a kind of an outline on the board so you can follow easier. The path that Yeats followed is a combination of occult teachings plus mysticism. You don't want us to talk about that? We're in trouble. This is basically a set of disciplines which are to prepare the mind. And this is basically a series of meditations for reception and unity. The three aspects of this path are yoking, gnosis, and expression. The yoking to the knowledge of and the expression of information about the incarnate ego. The soul, the anima mundi, the secret fire, and God, or that which comes before all, nothing. No thing. I mean, you think of it the way Russ Lockhart would, it's no thing. Alive. The rose itself is many things and is both ever-present and unobtainable. It is spiritual love, eternal beauty, woman's beauty, peace and beauty, passion and suffering, Ireland, Madgon, the feminine, the rose as impulse to life, which he calls the feminine, versus the lily, which is the impulse to death, or the masculine. It is that which all souls thirst for, and when combined with the tree of life, or a golden cross, it represents the reconciliation of opposites of the spirit having to reconcile to matter. Once the seeker is awakened to the full potential of a spiritual existence, though still incarnate, still in a body, the rose can become the truth that we seek, and the many varieties of roses become the many aspects of the true nature of the full creation. Thus, there are many travelers on the path, and a variety of paths to the truth, and ultimately all paths lead to the one eternal truth, which is symbolized by the great spirit fire. One can shrink from the rose and seek earthly love, but the price of such a failure is eternal discontent. So one of the ways he looked at his life is that he was lucky that the woman he loved did not return his love, because had he settled for life with her, he would never have done his work. He believed that all of his poetry was an attempt to explain himself to her. So I will walk you through, with the help of his poetry and some quotes from his essays, the steps that one along the path of the rose would take. The first stage is simply awakening, awakening to the possibility that there is a larger life. This comes to us in glimpses of flashes of knowing, insight. We are never allowed to stay in those moments for long. There's a beautiful insight by Kabir that seeing this for one moment makes you a disciple for life. And this is the way Jung would have talked about certain aspects of the collective unconscious. Certainly Yeats talks that way about the rose. You cannot have the rose. It is only there for you in another realm. And he had his first great vision of the rose, and he describes her this way. Many years ago, I saw sleeping, between sleeping and waking, a woman of incredible beauty shooting an arrow into the sky. And from the moment when I made my first guess at her meaning, I have thought much of the difference between the winding movement of nature and the straight line described by the mark of a sage or a saint. I think that we who are poets and artists, not being permitted to shoot beyond the tangible, must go from desire to weariness, and so back to desire. And we live but for the moment when vision comes to our weariness like a terrible lightning. And he really believed that that was the moment of his awakening to the fact that it really wasn't the woman that he thought he loved that was making him so miserable. It was really this other life that was beckoning. And this woman that he saw in the light of the moon became his rose. The second stage is becoming aware of what Yeats would call a remnant. It's what other people would call a spark. That spark of the great anima mundi that is incarnate in us, that makes us a part of heaven and of divine things. The second step is to realize that within ourselves is a remnant of the rose, and we can use that remnant to go within and begin the concept, the works, the preparation for becoming a disciple of the rose. The part of us that springs from the spirit fire is carried within the heart, and so one of the aspects of this kind of spiritual alchemy is that it is basically a path of heart, including the mental aspects of it. You are led there by great desire. And so he talks about it in a poem called The Lover Tells of the Rose in His Heart. All things uncomely and broken, all things worn out and old, the cry of the child by the roadway, the creak of the lumbering cart, the heavy steps of the plowman, splashing the wintry mold, are wronging your image that blossoms a rose in the deeps of my heart. The wrong of unshapely things is a wrong too great to be told. I hunger to build them anew and sit on a green knoll apart, with the earth and the sky and the water remade like a casket of gold for my dreams of your image that blooms a rose deep in my heart. So he is now 28. He has spent 7 long years in unrequited love, and he is beginning to get the picture that it's internal and not external. It was about that time that he and several friends really set to work to rebuild the Celtic twilight. They wanted a new Celtic Renaissance. They wanted to bring back to Ireland the old ways, and they wanted to reintroduce the bardic way of poetry and song and storytelling. And he set about collecting a lot of the folk tales of Ireland. The third stage is coming to know what the incarnating ego has to do. When we go through all of these cycles of incarnation, basically it's to experience all aspects of life. And his great work, A Vision, is really about the 28 phases of incarnation that seem to be the minimum and the required knowledge that the soul must complete while here in a body. And the best acceptance in some of his early work is in a little poem called Fergus and the Druid, and it's the last stanza. Fergus has been talking to a druid who he's watched all day long, and he goes from shape to shape. And Fergus wants to do that, and the druid finally says, "Well, what is it you want?" And he said, "I feel the crown heavy on my head, and I really would like to give it over to someone else, and I would like to learn what you're doing." And so at that moment, he understands that the real work here is the constant acceptance of plurality and change. And Fergus says finally, "I see my life go dripping like a stream from change to change. I have been many things, a green drop in the surge, a gleam of light upon a sword, a fir tree on a hill, an old slave grinding at a heavy quern, a king sitting upon a chair of gold, and all these things were wonderful and great. But now I have grown nothing, being all. and the whole world weighs down upon my heart. Ah, Druid, Druid, how great webs of sorrow lay hidden in this small slate-colored thing. So the glory is within, and the body is the slate-colored thing. If you're going to tread this path, then the first step is to figure out what aspect you're working on. Ultimately, you'll have to do it all. But the first delineation, there are three paths. The rose of the world, the rose of battle, and the rose of peace. And they pretty much go this way: heart, mind, and transcendence. Yeats believed that in this particular lifetime he was on the path of battle. And he believed that his friend Ahmad Gan was on the path of the world. And he believed that his friend A.E. Russell was on the path of the Rose of Peace. The path of the Rose of the World is very emotional. And it's all heartfelt. And it has to do with wandering and experiencing all and moving from desire to desire. The rose of the world. Who dreamed that beauty passes like a dream? For these red lips, with all their mournful pride, mournful that no new wonder may be tied, Troy passed away in one high funeral gleam, and Usna's children died. We and the laboring world are passing by, amid men's souls that waver and give place, like the pale waters in their wintry race, under the passing stars. Foam of the sky lives on this lonely face. Bow down, archangels, in your dim abode, before you were, or any hearts to beat, weary and kind, one lingered by his seat. He made the world to be a grassy road before her wandering feet. So the path of the world is simply before you, and it would be like in the fairy tales where the young hero or the heroine throws the ball in front or holds the stick up and follows where the ball will go. So in his poetry, you can think of Red Hanrahan, who wandered, or the fool, or Crazy Jane. Think about Maud Gonne in her battle world. She really was trying to salvage all of Ireland. And she had many loves, and she had many experiences, very, very much a woman of her time.
So it's a forward thinking.
It's always pulling you. The heart pulls. I mean, it's fickle, you know. It pulls us, and it's because we just have to experience the world. He actually believed Jesus was on the path of the world when he began, because he had to seek and he had to live among the people and he had to learn how to become a storyteller. So when he got to the Garden of Gethsemane, we then have the Rose of Battle. You see, Jesus did all three paths in one incarnation. The Rose of Battle is the play of the opposites, and they're played out in your mind. Anyone who continues to battle out in the world has probably not learned yet that the battle is within. And so this is part of the alchemical path of the reconciliations of opposites within you. The Rose of Battle. Rose of all roses, rose of all the world. The tall, thought-woven sails that flap unfurled above the tide of hours and trouble the air, and God's bell buoyed to be the water's care, While hushed from fear or loud with hope, a band with blown, spray-dabbled hair gather at hand. Turn if you may from battles never done, I call, as they go by me one by one. Danger no refuge holds, and war no peace, for him who hears love sing and never cease, beside her clean-swept hearth, her quiet shade. But gather all for whom no love have made a woven silence, but came to cast a song into the air, and singing passed a smile on the pale dawn. And gather you who have sought more than is in rain or dew, or in the sun and moon, or on the earth, or sighs amid the wandering starry mirth, or comes in laughter from the sea's sad lips. Come and wage God's battle in the long gray ships. The sad, the lonely, the insatiable, to these old night shall all her mystery tell. God's bell has claimed them by the little cry of their sad hearts that may not live or die. Rose of all roses, rose of all the world, you too have come where the dim tides are hurled upon the wharves of sorrow and heard ring the bell that calls us on, the sweet far thing, beauty grown sad with its eternity, made you of us and of the dim gray sea. Our long ships loose thought-woven sails and wait, for God has bid them share an equal fate. They have gone down, God has bid them share an equal fate, and when at last defeated in their war, they have gone down under the same white stars. We shall no longer hear that little cry of our sad hearts that may not live or die. Our long ships loose thought-woven sails. That's the place of the battle. And when he was writing these poems, he was very much involved in Ireland's quest for freedom. And he had begun a long period of time where he was writing political poems for the Irish Rebellion. And there was a point when he was about 45 years old that he became very upset about the possibility that the battle that he was waging was misplaced. And he began to consider that Ireland's men were dying partly because of his poetry. He had written such inspiring battle poetry. And he wrote a play called The Unicorn from the Stars when he was 44 years old, in which he reconsiders the possibility that the battle man has to fight is in his mind. And at that point, he stopped the poetry and he said, men such as I, poets, have nothing to say to politicians. Later, about 15 years later, you find him very involved in the Irish Senate he did it for 15 years. From about age 50 up through 65, he was a member of the Irish Senate. So he stopped the poetry of battle, turned to his own spiritual battle, and then became involved in the Senate as an appropriate place to put this kind of Reformation energy. The rose of spirit is the transcendent life, or the life that is attempting to be beyond the heart and beyond the mind. His friend A.E. wrote a lot of very spiritual poetry. One of them you might enjoy reading is The Candle of Vision, little essays with some poetry that really are very much, they're very cerebral in a way, but they're also transcendent of life. Yeats was not able to do that. Yeats was someone very much involved in matters of the heart and matters of politics. And he believed that because of the path he had chosen when he incarnated, that there was really no choice for him but to learn to balance the spirit world and the third dimensional earthly world. However, A.E. believed that he should seek the fire of the rose itself and try to get his life into an essential place rather than a distracted place. This is the rose of peace. If Michael, leader of God's host, when heaven and hell are met, looked down on you from heaven's doorpost, he would his deeds forget. Brooding no more upon God's wars in his divine homestead, he would go weave out of the stars a chaplet for your head. And all folk seeing him bow down and white stars tell your praise would come at last to God's great town, led on by gentle ways. And God would bid his warfare cease, saying all things were well, and softly make a rosy peace, a peace of heaven and hell. Okay, once you're clearly on the path of soul, one of the next steps is to become very much in contact with what Yeats called the anima mundi. So this is where the yoga begins. This is where the path of linking in meditation to receive metaphors for poetry began. And this is written in Yeats' early life when he was 32. This is called the Anima Mundi. I came to believe in a great memory passing from generation to generation. But that was not enough. For these images showed intention and choice. They had a relation to what one knew, and yet were an extension of one's knowledge. If no mind was there, why should I suddenly come upon salt and antimony, upon the liquefaction of gold, as they were understood by the old alchemists, or upon some detail of catalysm, a symbolism verified at last by a learned scholar from his never-published manuscripts. And who could have put together so ingeniously, working by some law of association, and yet with clear intention and personal application, certain mythological images? So this is the anima mundi, or the collective unconscious in our terms. He also gives an image here of our daily thought certainly is but a line of foam along this vast sea. So each of us is on the edge of that anima mundi. One of the things that Yeats's spiritual discipline required was the discipline of the mind, to prepare the mind, and he did that in his 40s. He studied esoteric philosophy for about 10 years. He read Plato, he read Plotinus, he read a lot of the Renaissance philosophers. He became acquainted with Swedenborg's work, and he decided that he didn't like it because Swedenborg was going to found a church, and he remained faithful to the concept that we are on this path alone. He studied magical concepts. And one of the reasons for studying the magical concept was to rise on the planes, to leave the veil of man's confusion behind. And the more that he studied, the more he began to understand that the way the anima mundi was built is for us to carry upon our death to the anima mundi our memory. And that memory is for a time our external world between incarnations. And all passionate moments recur again and again, for passion desires its own recurrence more than any other event. So one of the ways that your soul develops is to move into the anima mundi and, as part of that memory, collect about yourself all of the things of desire. When you have distilled that and are once more ready to incarnate, you come back in to do a specific kind of life that will hone the information or the skills that you need for the next step. So all of this discipline was really meant to prepare the mind while you're here so that the ideas that you came to remember can contact you. It does no good for the idea to fall on an unprepared or infertile mind. So this was the reason for his study. He also believed that we were living in a time of change and that at the end of every millennium, there is a cleansing and a purification of not only the incarnate beings, but the anima mundi itself, and that this is necessary because after 2,000 years, which is what the millennia is, the anima mundi begins to have mistakes and the ideas don't come through to us quite strongly enough. And so all of the upheaval that comes around moving from, say, Capricorn into Aquarius, it's necessary for the anima mundi to be renewed. So he predicted, as did Nostradamus, great periods of change toward the end of the century. He saw great battles. He believed that the unicorns would come and carry the energies of the cleansing and pound the energy of the cleansing into the planet and thus bring the energy from the stars once more and renew the planet. And that's right out of the unicorn from the stars. The anima mundi is where all dwells. And all images are there. And all history is there. And all the kings are there. And all the queens are there. And all the gods and goddesses are there. The angels are not there because they gave up having that colorful, passionate life. And instead of being like sapphires and rubies, they wear cloaks of gray because they are not meant to be more shining than God's beings, God's creatures. But we're lucky because we can have this color and this passion. And one of the most beautiful poems is called The Secret Rose, which is something he wrote when he was 32 years old. And this is the anima mundi. Far off, most secret and inviolate rose, enfold me in my hour of hours. And where those who sought thee in the holy sepulchre or in the wine vat dwell beyond the stir and tumult of defeated dreams. And deep among pale eyelids, heavy with the sleep men have named beauty. Thy great leaves enfold the ancient beards, the helms of ruby and gold of the crowned magi, and the king whose eyes saw the pierced hands and root of elder rise in druid vapor and make the torches dim till vain frenzy arose and he died. And him who met fond walking among flaming dew by a gray shore where the wind never blew and he lost the world and Ymir for a kiss. And him who drove the gods out of their lists until 100 morns had flowered red, feasted and wept the barrows of his dead. And the proud dreaming king who flung the crown and sorrow away and calling bard and clown dwelt among wine-stained wanderers in deep woods. And him who sold tillage and house and goods and sought through lands and islands numberless years until he found with laughter and with tears a woman of so shining loveliness that men threshed corn at midnight by a tress, a little stolen tress. I too await the hour of thy great wind of love and hate. When shall the stars be blown about the sky like the sparks blown out of a smithy and die? Surely thine hour has come, thy great wind blows. Far off, most secret and inviolate rose. So you see, she's quite a lady. She is going to enfold us and finally consume us. Beyond the anima mundi is the great fire rose itself. This is beyond the memory of our species, of our incarnating souls. This is the world that Plato describes of the elements and all of the forms. But to Yeats, there was only one form and one element, and this was the spirit fire. This is where all things are unified and expressed in the simplicity of a fire rose. And this is a story of an old knight, and it's called Out of the Rose. One winter evening, an old knight in rusted chain armor rode slowly along the woody southern slope of Ben Bulben, watching the sun go down in crimson clouds over the sea. His horse was tired as after a long journey, and he had upon his helmet the crest of no neighboring king, but a small rose made of rubies that glimmered with every moment to a deeper crimson. His white hair fell in thin curls upon his shoulders, and its disorder added to the melancholy of his face, which was the face of one of those who come but little into the world, and always for its trouble, the dreamers who must do what they dream, and the doers who must dream what they do. After gazing a while toward the sun, he let the reins fall upon the neck of his horse, and stretching out both arms to the west, he said, "O divine rose of intellectual flame, let the gates of thy peace be opened to me at last." Well, he attracted a crowd, and they all gathered round to find out what he was doing. And they said, "Well, you know, are you a wizard? Are you a teacher? You know, this is very strange that you're wandering. Who are you?" And so the old knight says, "Well, I'll tell you about myself. For now that I am the last of a fellowship, I may tell all and witness for God. Look at this rose of rubies on my helmet and see the symbol of my life and my hope. I live in a far land from this, and I was one of the knights of an ancient order who always longed for more arduous labors in the service of the truth that can only be understood from the heart. At last there came to us a knight from Palestine to whom the truths had been revealed by God himself. He had seen a great rose of fire, and a voice out of the rose had told him how men would turn from the light of their own hearts and bow down before outer order and outer fixity, and that then the light would cease, and none escape the curse, except the foolish good man who could not think, and the passionate wicked man who would not think. Already, the voice told him, the light of the heart was shining with less luster, and as it paled, an infection was touching the world and was corruption itself. And none of those could enter the kingdom of God, which is the heart of the very voice of God which spoke through to us through the night. And we told him to direct us in all things and teach us how to obey the voice." So this great rose that comes to warn us of what happens if you stay attached to life, basically to corruption, requires a vision of this larger fire. Then, the next step, let's see, what have we got here? We had anima mundi. And then the secret fire. And now we have no thing. If you are alive after you have glimpsed the rose, and that's a big if, because there are many perils that come to seekers along the path. The old Kabbalists say that the four who sought the seventh heaven, one lost his body, one lost his mind, one went in silence and returned in silence, but the third was the most dangerous of all. He came, he saw, he came back, and he was a heretic, and he led others along the wrong path. So having a little knowledge is probably more dangerous than having a lot of knowledge, and sometimes it can cost you your sanity, and sometimes the energy is too great, and it can cost you your life. So one out of four, we could say, of these seekers can receive this knowledge. If you're lucky, and this is a big if, you can move beyond the fire and you can glimpse for a moment the place of the origin that was before the fire. If we move to the place before the fire and we accept the silence, then you will know such peace as no one could ever describe. It is the music of the spheres. It is the harmony. It is before the movement. And it, of course, is before the passion of the rose. This is a story about a brother, very much like St. Patrick, who has come to teach the children. And they said to him, "Brother Dove, to what are the stars fastened?" And the brother, rejoicing to see so much curiosity in the stupidest of his scholars, laid down the pen and said, "There are 9 crystalline spheres, and on the first the moon is fastened, on the second the planet Mercury, and on the third the planet Venus, and on the fourth the sun, on the fifth the planet Mars, on the sixth the planet Jupiter, and on the seventh the planet Saturn. These are the wandering stars. And on the eighth are fastened the fixed stars, but the ninth sphere is a sphere of the substance on which the breath of God moved in the very beginning." "Well, what is beyond that?" said the children. "Well, there's nothing beyond that. There is God." Well, the child's eyes then strayed to the jeweled box where one great ruby was gleaming in the light of the fire. And he said, "Well, what is this great ruby that you have put on the side of the box?" And Brother Dove said, "The ruby is the symbol of the love of God." "Well, why is the ruby a symbol of the love of God?" "Well, because it is red. It is like fire. But fire burns up everything. So where there is nothing, there is God." So you begin to hear how Yeats thinks. I mean, and you also begin to understand that life in a body is very complicated, and as we move along in the business of the soul, which is distillation as a spiritual alchemist, it gets simpler and simpler and simpler. And when Yeats was only 17 years old, and very able to articulate it in essays by the age of 20, he had set out for his life to hammer all thought into unity. And he wanted to bring everything into correspondence, which was why the magical path was a natural for him, because all of magic is worked by correspondence. And so bringing everything so that it is related. Again, you can hear his function. I mean, this is a feeling function that operates very well. He wants everything related. He wants it condensed to a few symbols that can carry him for all of his life. So those of you who work with introverted feeling types and you despair at their paucity of symbolism, think of them more like this. They don't need a lot of symbols. They can make a lifetime out of 3 or 4 major symbols. They will relate everything to those symbols. They'll drive you crazy because everything is related to everything. And you know, this I used to do this at, you know, I'd draw the umbrella and I'd say, "And then you have to draw all these little lines down here, but I can't do the little lines, I have to do the big one first." And you keep pushing it until you find the one symbol that will hold all of your life together. And of course, things really break apart when the symbol fails. And that is the dark night of the soul for a feeling type, is the failure of that one symbol that was supposed to carry it all. So I'm going to make one final quote, then we're going to take a break, and then come back in and let you have an opportunity to question. Think about the life that is a spark incarnated in a body, a soul in a body. There are two realities, the terrestrial and the condition of fire. All power is from the terrestrial condition, for there all opposites are meet, and there only is the extreme of choice possible, full freedom. And there the heterogeneous is, and evil. For evil is the strain one upon another of the opposites. But in the condition of fire is all music and all rest. Between the condition of air, where images have but a borrowed life, that of memory, or that reflected upon them when they symbolize colors and intensities of fire, this is the place of shades who are in the whirl of those who are fading. When all the sequences come to an end, after so many rhythmic beats, the soul must cease to desire these images, and then it can close its eyes. When all these sequences come to an end, time comes to an end, and the soul puts on the rhythmic or spiritual body or luminous body and contemplates all the events of its memory and every possible impulse in an internal possession of itself in one single moment. So you think about that while you have a short meandering. You know, you can't ever make me do it in a straight line, so I'll be happy to do that. Yeats' path was a combination of occult teachings and mysticism. He disciplined his mind and prepared it with a lot of philosophy work and esoteric studies. He was a student of the Golden Dawn, student of Renaissance magic, and a series of meditations. And this all prepared him to receive a metaphor for his poetry. There were three aspects of Yeats' path. We could call it a Western yoga, a yoking. We could call it a path of Gnosticism, Gnosis. And we could call it a path of expression. Specifically, he wanted knowledge of the incarnating ego, the spark. He wanted knowledge of the soul. He wanted knowledge of the anima mundi, the secret fire, and the nothing. And he did this by forming an intentional life. This was a man who disciplined himself more and more as the years went by to be what we would call meditating 24 hours a day. What that meant to him was the same thing it would mean to a yogi, which is you are always aware and in the moment and paying attention to what is going on around you. It is not a mental thing for Yeats, however. It was a heart thing, so he paid attention to his emotions. He placed his products, so to speak, in the culture and in art. He believed that he had to balance these two things because it was always a battle for him to either be entirely a writer or entirely a politician. So for him, he had to find a way to balance out his political activities with the writing of his poetry and his plays. He was a very energetic person in spite of major illnesses. He had respiratory illnesses most of his life, and he was, for a literary man, almost blind. He had to read with very thick glasses, and his eyes were not up to it, but he managed to become quite self-educated in spite of it. The path of soul, once you discover that you have an incarnating ego or a soul, there are three paths that you have to choose from. Actually, it's chosen for you by the soul. You will discover that you are either a heart person, a mind person, or a transcendent kind of spirit person. And those are going to be thrust at you by fate or destiny or the body of fate. If you get off the path, you basically will suffer and you will have great discontentment. Once you've understood your path or your soul urge, you can then begin moving back into the larger or place of origin, literally, back into the spirit world. First through contacting the Anima Mundi. We would call that working with the archetypes of the collective unconscious. Using those to learn more and more about yourself, your world, your path. The species, becoming entirely human, but not in the third dimensional sense, but in the essential sense, the form sense. Finally, being able to move even beyond the anima mundi into the secret fire, where all things are unified and there's great harmony, and all the color and all the sound. And then, because this is a fire after all, it burns itself out, and where there is nothing, and in the silence, you begin to understand the nature of God, or the origin, or the place from which we came. So that's basically his path. Yeah.
you mentioned that Yates seems to be living in the path of the mind,
the battle.
Mm-hmm. And then that later in his life he became a statesman, a censor.
Well, right. The mind for him caused him to want to involve himself in these two. It was always a fight. It's the play of the opposites in full color.
What I was curious about was, did he move from being in the place of the mind to the rose of the world? Or did he believe that we live in one or the other of these souls, arenas, or how did that work?
Well, he believed that someone like Jesus did all three paths in one incarnation because he was our teacher. He believed in a world teacher that came at the beginning of every millennium to teach us the pattern for the next 2,000 years. And so we were, you could say, from the example we were given, we were meant to understand these three paths in the years that have ensued. Right. I think this was Yeats's belief. The Golden Dawn would have maybe agreed with this, but this idea comes from a little essay of his that he wrote when he was young and still not very involved in the Golden Dawn. I believe that these three paths are essential to most of the spiritual teachings of esoteric schools. I mean, this is not original to Yeats. And the thing that is true about Yeats is he is, the whole point of the Anima Mundi is that it was all received. It's all universal knowledge. It's all there for us to receive and interpret in our own lives. Why he believed he was on the rose of battle is that his whole life just seemed full of conflict. And yet you could say he was very much in the world. Why he would say he was in the rose of battle rather than the rose of the world is that his life was very intentional. He did not just go where the road led. He began to hone his life very early. Whereas others, like Maud Gonne, went from battle to battle. She never could see that she was about to be thrown in jail, or she never could see really very far ahead of where that path took her on the next step. It's just a path of experience and very much led by desire. Now, his friend A.E. wasn't much in the world. He really was a student and a scholar, and he was always trying to get Yeats to stop all that politics and attend to your poetry and, you know, think about God a little more. And Yeah.
You compared Yeats and Jung in the beginning. I would like a little clearer analysis of the similarity of their beliefs and whether Jung was influenced by Yeats at all.
We had this discussion. Actually, Russ Lockhart and I are very interested in Yeats. And it's our belief, our conclusion, that neither read the other. And Russ was the one who supplied that information to me. He basically said that Jung was not interested in either esoteric studies of this nature or in poetry. And Yeats didn't read German. And in any case, a lot of what we're talking about here was written after Yeats was dead. Jung's writings began about the time that Yeats was dying. For example, the alchemy part was, Yeats was already dead when Jung worked on his statements about alchemy. The thing I believe is that in the anima mundi are these ideas. And these are great men with great minds. And it's like these ideas came to them from the same source. Each in their own type gave us a literature that helped us have access to these ideas. Yeats as a feeling type left a heritage of poetry. Jung as a thinker gave us elucidated and philosophic writing of a more didactic manner. So I think you could make comparisons, but probably not carry it very far.
It's very much the same in his finding that throughout history there have been
five or six people, exactly.
Ideas.
Right.
And Buddha and Jesus were similar in many ways.
That's right. That's right.
There have been many, many other
right.
instances in life, so that in other words, these are eternal beliefs.
That's my belief.
That is,
they are so important. My analyst is David Hart, and he's a fairy tale man, and we always talk about the four or five fairy tales that we love, no matter, you know, we can do it from those. And he always says, you know, there are very few important things, and they are worth saying over and over and over. And these ideas that were begun, really, you have to think about Thomas Taylor, the Platonist, who early in the 1800s began the philosophical discourse that led to this work, and William Blake, the poet, who began the what we could call channeling aspects of the poetic work. So you have, with Blake and Thomas Taylor, these ideas are back. Then you move into 1865 to 1920 with the Golden Dawn and Yeats and A.E. and all of those poets and playwrights doing the feeling side of it. Then you move into Europe with Jung and the psychologies working on the mind side of it. I think these ideas are so important that we, you know, it's almost like the anima mundi wants it said as many possible ways as it can. And it continues.
Mm-hmm. I would like to further understand the fire of the somehow I have it connected up with the transcendent aspect of the soul.
It is, but it's the aspect of the soul that transcends the species and this planet entirely. So think of all three aspects are required to do the work of the soul. When you've completed that, the soul with a capital S wants some contact with, it's like the mother of this world. But then you really want to know the real mother. You want to go back to the original fire. And when think about Plato trying to talk about the harmony of the spheres. Think about what is beyond the anima mundi of this experience of mankind. Well, forms, elements, energies, fire. So he would even go so far as to say, she is air, because it's all memory and mind. And this is fire. This is water, because the soul flows from life to life. And this is no thing. I mean, it's before the elements. And this gray worm is Earth, the planet, the body of the planet, the body of the soul is the Earth, which is corruptible. It lives and dies. So even in the four elements, you can see it in the paths.
And it contains the four elements.
That's right. Yep.
How much do you believe that he was influenced by the poetry and the interaction of poetry and magic of pre-Christian Ireland? How much is that influenced?
Very much.
And how much the integration of that into the Roman liturgy influenced him also? Is there a theological?
He has no theological influence. He was raised by an agnostic father. He was, in his mind, free because he didn't have to deal with the church. So he was free to return to Ireland's roots. Now, the Golden Dawn was... one of the reasons he left the Golden Dawn is it became very Christian after Mathers went to France. Before Mathers, you would say it was a Rosicrucian society. Now, there are Christ-light teachings in Rosicrucianism, but as a Christian theology, it would not hold water. So Yeats, you know, he got his... The best you could say about his Christian background is that he got it through Swedenberg. Which is, I don't know if you've ever read Emanuel Swedenborg's work, but it's a very strange thing. The other source is William Blake. I would say if any one writer influenced Yeats, it was Blake. So it's a Kabbalistic, tree of life-based teaching. He was more at home. He knew some Hebrew. And he knew some Greek. So he was more at home with the secret teachings of Kabbalism than he was with New Testament teachings, for example.
I was rather interested in his political involvement. I was working out the years. It seems around about 1922 when the Stallman first came in.
Yep.
And that with his non-theological approach in a theology-based politics.
Right, right. Right.
There's a famous quote from the same thing that says, "We got an awful lot from Yeats from someone
who didn't believe." Right. So he was really going back to the Celtic religion. That's right. He wanted a Celtic twilight. But you see, this man was born religious, and he said so. He knew at the age of 9 that he was a religious man. So his religion was... you know, in a way, it's very Jungian when you think of it. You know, Jung always talked about the church is failing us, and to find a new myth, we have to forge our own. And then there's a spring, I guess about 1972, there was an analyst from England who went to see Jung, and he was very depressed and burned out, and he didn't want to continue as an analyst. And he... went to Jung to consult him about this, and he had a dream which he forgot to tell him, and then only when he was back on the train did he remember his dream. And so he wrote to Jung the dream, and the dream was simply of a church that was being built, and it seemed to be interdenominational, or people from many lands. And he sent that dream to Jung, and Jung said, yes, that's it, we're building a new church, and it will take about 600 years. So we're forging new ways. And the reason for that is I mean, inherent in Yeats's belief that this anima mundi is worn out and failing, and it has to be renewed, and it has to be renewed from the spiritual world. It's the spirit that needs renewing. So, that's it.
So then the way that we all participate in that is through the access of the images from the unconscious and bringing those images in.
Trying to understand them, trying to elucidate them, trying to correct them. That's like the interchange of the energies. So we do our work by becoming conscious of this other world. And we do our work by living within those images as best we can. Well, in a sense, the kind of alchemy he was interested in was based on spiritual Kabbalism. He was not an alchemist in the truest sense. The kind of alchemy that the Druids knew about. The kind of alchemy that the Hebrews, the Greeks, and the Egyptians knew about. So it's a different kind of alchemy, very distinctly so, than what Jung was writing about. Different schools, yeah.
It went back to more to the origins.
To Greece.
Rather than the Renaissance.
Right, right. I would think of Yeats as very Greek as he thought about alchemy. It's based on initiation. It's based on soul development, an alchemy of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Dialogue, lots of dialogue. That's what the plays are all about. Passionate plays. Mm-hmm. If you haven't read Yeats' plays, it would be really fun for us to do one because they are so incredible. They're wonderful with big masks. I mean, you want the archetypes. The mask is this big, and that's really very neat. I've seen a few of them through the years, very rarely. It's not easy to do because I think that it would take an educated audience. We'd have to do a workshop, and I could teach you a lot, and then we could do it. But I think just to go to one of Yeats' plays, you'd probably go out of there and go, jeez. But I'll do it if you guys want to do it. Well, I believe that a lot of the work that was done in correspondences, all those lists, all of those, when you think about the tarot, when you think about the system of correspondences that was developed by Crowley, I mean, what a sensate function that man had. And he had to act it all out. Aleister Crowley had to act it all out. He had costumes, he had altars, he had capes, you know, and this memory that could do all this correspondence. And I think, I'm trying to think of some of those wonderful, Thomas Agrippa, who made all of the it's like big images with all the names of God and all the names of the tribes of Israel and all of the names of all the angels. And you're supposed to remember that, you know. That's a very sensate way. Yeah.
Yeah. In response to that question, were there some painters?
Yeats? Most of his friends were poets and writers. His father was a pre-Raphaelite painter, and one of Yeats's own brothers really was one of the better, post. I don't know what age Jack Yeats would have been. He's like 1900 to 1930. He was a very fine painter. And he actually wrote short stories of his own. So I would say that Yeats interfaced with his brother and his father on the idea level. Interesting enough, Yeats went to the university to study art and lasted one semester. and decided at the end of it that he wanted to be a poet, and he left. So he left the university and he began his own self-education. But in a way, you could say his father always influenced him, because probably was saying to Yeats at some point, you know, your writing's not very good, you should have been a painter. But he sort of nagged him all through his life and was very influential for many years. Yeah.
Can you say something about the world, but about the unicorn and
Well, the instruments of the cleansing. If you think about, there's a play that he writes called The Unicorn from the Stars. And he was using this play as a vehicle to decide whether or not to write any more war poems. But he was also giving a vision of his. And the vision that he had was that at the end of the millennium there would be a cleansing. And that this kind of, and he embeds it into the play in terms of an image of unicorns stamping and tramping and breaking the earth apart. And then where there is nothing, there is God. So in this case, what he's really saying is that there is this problem at the end of the millennium, that the anima mundi and the earth has to be renewed and our bodies have to be renewed, and we evolve as a species. Every millennium we have new lessons as a species. So to get rid of the old and bring in the new, something pretty violent happens. The secret rose, the winds of hate are blowing, that kind of thing. But in his play, it's the unicorns who trample the earth, run around the earth, bringing in the energy from the stars. And as they bring the light from the stars in, they certainly break apart the earth, but they also bring in the renewal energy. So they are instruments.
Mm-hmm. This question probably revealed either my typology or my ignorance of both. I'm confused, at least somewhat confused by, on the one hand, he seems to be a very passionate man who believes in the passion of life. But on the other hand, he seems to reject the physical life. He's in a kind of Gnostic way of saying, well, the body is simply the gray hull that we have to carry around, and doesn't seem to talk or experience the physical life as being embodied with soul.
Well, it's a curious thing. He's introverted feeling. You have to think about that in terms of what kind of a life that implies. The other thing you must remember is that if a person looks at life as a lesson, then this is a vehicle. It's just a car, and you drive it, and you do it well, or you don't do it well. So it isn't that he despises human life. He is one of the things he talks about is Plotinus, who was embarrassed to have a body at all. Plotinus was very embarrassed that he still had a body. And Porphyry was very suicidal all of his life because he had a body. It was like, oh dear, this shameful thing. And Yeats did not feel that way, but it was the life itself that was more important to him than the physical life. He felt that if you just dwell on the physical life, it's just like a brute. So mind and heart and spirit are his definition of life. And he married. He had children. He had lovers. He had a political life. He fought with his friends. He was a senator. I think he had a very full life. But it was always examined from the position of what was in it for his soul.
He married the woman who wrote all the poems?
No, he did not. He married a woman who was 27 years younger. It was an arranged marriage. Her mother came to him, and because he was a senator, he was a good catch. He was 52, and George Lee Hyde was 27. She was rather strange. She was a medium and an occult practitioner, and she was a trance medium who could bring in information. So Yeats thought that was a very good deal. But in fact, the reason he accepted is that he had proposed to Maud Gonn for the 900th time only 5 days before, and that didn't work. She said no. And then he proposed to Isolde, who was Maud Gonn's daughter, because he figured that he would take care of Isolde. And she said no, and so he was very depressed. And when Mrs. Lee Hyde came and said, "Would you marry my daughter?" he said yes, and so he was married in a civil ceremony 5 days later. Yes. She has become very, very important. I mean, when you think about all of the beautiful things that we have to read, all of his notes, everything he's ever written, all of the painstaking work that he did, she has cataloged and prepared. His daughter, Ann Yeats, is his publicist. So a lot of his work is available from a family-run press, the Koala Press.
The life of the poet, the life of the senator, is clear from the literature you're talking about, the production of the life of the poet. But what was the legacy of the senator? What sort of things did he work for? Was he effective?
The poor man, he wrote a letter once to Ezra Pound, and warning Ezra Pound to change his ways and get out of politics because it was very dangerous to his health if he didn't. Ezra Pound didn't listen, of course, and Yeats kind of washed his hands of it. But in the letter, he said, you know, he said, there's no place for us. He said, they fight, they carry on, they do all of these things. He said, I spend days working on a 15-minute speech for the Senate because I think the topic is important. And he said, everybody listens, and then as soon as I sit down, they go right on back to what they were talking about. So I don't really know what he was trying to do. I think he was trying to bring some elevation to the fighting. He was very concerned about human lives. He got upset about the war carrying on right around the State House, and they had guards at the door, and there was an attack, and the Senate never stopped their fighting and carrying on, and Yeats was worried about the young soldier who was guarding them, and that was the kind of cognitive dissonance that he was experiencing. He was in the Senate until he was 63, and his son took his Senate seat and was there. So they had a long history of social service, kind of a consciousness that way. So now you can go read Yeats. Yeah.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.